There are countless jobs that make a society function. What does it mean to perform a certain occupation? What are the day-to-day activities? This is Community Connections, and I'm your host, Heather Rose, and together, we aim to find out. Hi, this is Heather Rose of Community Connections, a program that chronicles the functions and everyday activities of the myriad roles we find in society. Joining us today is Richard Reeves, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of Boys and Men. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for being here.
Sure.
First off, can our listeners get a little background about yourself?
Yeah, so I work at the Brookings Institution, as you said. That's a policy think tank based in Washington, D.C. That's basically just trying to bring the best research to bear on education policy, foreign policy, labor market policy, whatever kind of area you want to think about. But I come to that from the UK. You can probably tell by now already that I'm not originally from these shores. I am now a proud US citizen, but I'm from the UK originally. I came here 10 years ago. And in the UK, I'd served in government as well as in some academic and think tank roles and journalism. So I bounced around. But I'd say the through line of my career has been to try and bring sort of research skills to bear on pressing social issues. And this one about boys and men is one that's been bubbling on my to-do list for a long time now. And I've been writing about families and inequality for a long time. It seemed high time to look at specifically at boys and men.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get interested in the plight of boys and men?
The personal answer is I've raised three boys. I now have three sons, all in their 20s. And so I've raised them both in the UK and the US. And so that's just the experience of being a father to three has definitely affected my view of these things and some of the challenges today, frankly. But it was more my day job, actually, where I kept coming across evidence that boys and men are well behind in education now in most advanced economies, seeing huge challenges for a lot of men in the labor market, in the workplace. Just a lot of jobs have gone overseas. Automation has really affected male jobs very strongly. And then huge changes in family life, which actually mean that the role of the father has really been altered, transformed in many, many ways, potentially positively, but also potentially quite negatively. And so in these different ways, I can see a lot of difficulties for a lot of men. And in particular, because of my previous work was looking at inequality and a lot on issues around race, I see in particular the challenges faced by working class boys and men and black boys and men who are really at the sharp end of a lot of the social and economic changes of recent decades.
I see. So how do you think society defines manhood?
But, well, not very well at the moment, I would say. I think we're in this very difficult period where we've abandoned some of the older models of masculinity and manhood, and in many ways for good reason, because some of those old definitions were based on an inequality between men and women. Somehow, the idea that men were naturally superior to women, that men should occupy positions of power or as journalists, for example, Heather. And of course, that world has quite rightly now gone. But I don't think we've replaced that old idea of manhood as the patriarch, if you like, or even as a protector or provider with a new one. And in a world where 40% of breadwinners are women, you've got to update your model of what it means to be a man. Because if you define a man in the old way, protector, provider, boss, etc., then that won't work in a world where that's not true. And so I don't really feel that we've got much of a script anymore for what it means to be a good man. I think we have a lot of stories about how to be bad, how to be toxic, but I don't think there's a very strong positive message now or a positive framing of masculinity. And I think that's the gap into which many of our young men in particular are falling.
So what are some problems with this definition?
With the older definition of manhood, do you mean, or the new one?
The
older one. Well, I mean, one is that it's unrealistic in a world where it's not so achievable. So if you define it the old one and say provider, right? Let's just focus on that for a minute, right? You've got to be the main provider. It's certainly, maybe even the sole provider. There's a lot of people talking now about how you need to be able to raise a family on one wage, just like in the old days. And you sort of know whose wage they mean when they say that. But like most American men today earn less than most American men did in 1979. be honest. So median male wages have gone down in the last few decades. As I mentioned a moment ago, we've seen a huge increase in the number of women breadwinners. As I said, 40% of women earning more than the typical man. In a third of marriages, the woman is earning more than the husband. And so these are just as a result of women's economic rise, that totally changes the idea that the man should be the main provider. And so if we hang on to that idea of what it means to succeed as a man, then we are basically doomed to fail. Because of the extraordinary positive rise of women. So we have to expand the role. It's too narrow and it's too economically defined. And so we need to expand the role for men in the same way I would argue that we have successfully expanded the role for women. Mm-hmm. I think that it's been wonderful, right, that you get so much more choice now. I mean, the world of my mother and my wife and of, you know, my son's friends or my goddaughters is completely different in terms of this potential role. I mean, the message that we send to women now is quite rightly, you can be and do anything. Mm-hmm. So we've expanded the role of womanhood beyond that narrow one. But I think we haven't done such a good job of expanding the role of men, especially in areas like fatherhood and different careers they could pursue.
Mm-hmm. So how should society define manhood?
Well, that's in a way the million-dollar question, and therefore the one I should have the best answer to, but one I'm continuing to struggle with. But I do think that it has to start from a recognition that there are some average differences between men and women. They're not determinative. There shouldn't be a reason for discrimination. But on average, there are some differences between men and women. And where those differences can have positive aspects to them, we should recognize them. So we should celebrate physical courage, for example, when that's displayed by men. But we should not celebrate crazy risk-taking by boys and men. Those mm-hmm. are two sides of the same coin. And risk-taking is another area where on average, like men are a little bit more risk-taking than women. And obviously that can have a very dark side to it in terms of some risk-taking behaviors, but they can have some positive sides to it too, in terms of exploration and entrepreneurship, as long as it's balanced, as long as we're balanced around. So if there are positive aspects of masculinity, which are not restricted to men, many women will have these characteristics too, but on average, they're more likely to be found in men. Then we should be celebrating those as well as talking about some of the difficulties that that we have with the old definition. So I think those sorts of attributes we should talk about. But the most important thing, frankly, is to stop having a negative discussion about masculinity and stop defining it as what's wrong with it or why is it so different to femininity. And one of the reasons I think I'm struggling to answer the question is because I really think we're in the foothills of even thinking that question needs an answer now. Because there are some people who think, well, these definitions don't mean anything anymore. And other people who want to go back to the old one. In fact, we need to revise our model of masculinity. And that's a task upon which almost nobody, frankly, is engaged.
Indeed. So you say almost nobody. Do you know some people who are engaged in that?
I think actually I say that when I say not, I mean, at the political level or the think tank, you know, the policy level, the journalistic level, I don't think there are many people engaged in. I think people are a bit dug in to their tribal positions or their old-fashioned positions. But I actually think that a lot of, in real life, if you like, a lot of us are actually doing that. We're just doing it in our own homes. We're doing mm-hmm. it around the dinner table. We're doing it in our relationships. We're doing it in our dating relationship, whatever. So I think we're sort of struggling towards it. But then what you'll see is a lot of boys will go, or young men will go to the internet. They'll go to places where, you know, there's discussions going on about what's happening to boys and men. And if we don't actually engage in that discussion, then the dangers will just keep going deeper and deeper. And then you end up with there are some quite dark places that a lot of young men can end up in online.
I hear that. So what are some solutions that you propose?
In education, one thing I think we should do is start boys in school a year later than girls, because boys just develop later than girls. Like, everybody knows this. Every school principal or teacher I recommend say this idea to goes, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, duh. Their answer is like, well, duh. Like, everybody knows that a 15-year-old girl is on average, you know, more mature in terms of just her brain development than the 15-year-old boy. But girls hit puberty earlier. That triggers their brain development. So they're just a bit more, they're closer to adulthood at 15, 16. So I think it'd be better for boys to start a year later. I also think we need a lot more male teachers. Right now, only fewer than one in four K-12 teachers are male, and that number is dropping. So it's not just that there aren't very many men, there are fewer and fewer men over time in our classrooms teaching. And that does seem to affect boys' performance, especially in subjects like English. And so I think we need a national recruitment drive to get men into teaching. In just the same way we've worked really hard to try and get women into engineering and law and medicine and so on, we've now got to have an equivalent effort to get men into teaching. It's, I think, actually borderline scandalous that no one appears to be paying any attention to the fact that there are fewer and fewer men in our classrooms. And then I would say on education, the last one is much more investment in apprenticeships and vocational learning and training, which actually does work quite well for a lot of women and girls, but it seems to work particularly well for even more boys and men. But there's a kind of learning style which is a more vocational one, which does seem to work better for them. So I propose, for example, doubling the number of technical high schools in the US and 1,000 new technical high schools, which would double the number of students in those schools. And the last thing I'll say is I really would like to see a much greater focus on fatherhood and paid leave policies that treat fathers as equal to mothers and better treatment of fathers in the courts when they separate from the mothers. I think we are significantly undervaluing fatherhood right now in both our policy and our culture.
Me too. I see that. Yeah, friends who go through the court system and they're discriminated against because they're males.
It's particularly true for unmarried, actually. I mean, there's still some work to do in the divorce courts, but the divorce law has gotten quite a lot better in terms of how it treats fathers. And after divorce now, fathers get about a third of the time with their kids, which is a significant increase in recent years. And there are a lot of joint custody. There's very few sole custody decisions now on behalf of women after divorce. But unmarried parents don't have access to the divorce courts, of course, because they were never married. And so actually there's a very different system for unmarried fathers. Mm. The child support system obviously comes for money, but then there's a whole separate legal system around access and rights. And so it's that the legal system hasn't kept pace with the fact that 40% of children are now born outside marriage. And most children born to non-college educated women are born outside marriage. So marriage is not the norm for children's birth now for everyone except the college educated. And so we need a legal system that doesn't rely on marriage as the institution through which this will be organized. It's not to say I'm against marriage.
Oh yeah.
Been suggested. I mean, I'm not arguing against marriage. I'm just arguing about the world as it is rather than the world.
Right. As practical some people solutions.
Yeah. Right.
Indeed. I see that. So how do we go about enacting these solutions?
Well, some of them will have to happen at a policy level, so it'll require initiatives. But there are a number of initiatives that are being discussed along these lines. So, for example, an apprenticeship bill is in the Senate right now. 1 million new apprenticeships, that would really help men. Florida has just introduced a fatherhood initiative with unanimous support in the House in Florida. Every Democrat and every Republican voted for it in the House in Florida, which is to support fathers and to fund programs that will help fathers. I think that's a hugely important initiative. Washington State is considering a bill to create a commission on boys and men to support boys and men. So there are things happening at that sort of policy level, if you like. And I would also argue for scholarships to get men into teaching. Like, I think we need male-only scholarships to get men into teaching, just as we have female-only scholarships into STEM. But I think there's also something here about a person at a personal level, at a neighborhood level, at a family level, which is to just make sure we're showing compassion to the boys and men in our lives, that we are treating them equally. We're not somehow assuming, well, they'll be okay because they're male, because in fact, they're not okay. And are at high risk of all kinds of things like suicide, like opioid addiction, deaths of despair, and so on. And so I just think in the way that we interact in our daily lives, we should be doing a lot less finger pointing than we're currently doing, and offering many more helping hands to the boys and men in our lives.
That goes for everybody across the board. Mm. But so what does a typical workday look like for you?
Well, it does slightly depend on what stage I'm at in various projects. So I will say that right now it involves doing quite a lot of this, actually, Heather, because obviously I've fairly recently published this book. So I'm out there talking quite a lot to people about the book and traveling. But I would say that as I'm down at my desk, then after I've gone outside and got some light and had some coffee and run the dogs around, then I'll try and keep my mornings for writing. if at all possible. So try to keep my mornings clear to write and think and so on. And then in the afternoons, perhaps I'll be doing some meetings with policymakers or with colleagues at Brookings or working groups that I'm on. But I try to sort of think and write in the morning and you know, meet and greet in the afternoon, if I can make that work. So that's probably the idealized version of my working day. But I try, if possible, to function it that way. I always remember the story of Alan Greenspan when he was chair of the Federal Reserve, never took meetings in the morning. And I remember thinking at the time, well, if the chairman of the Federal Reserve can do that, surely more of us can do that.
Indeed. Well, we all have challenges. What are some of your everyday challenges?
I really struggle to sustain my attention on long running tasks. When one of my sons was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, and they said, you know, we were all sitting in the room and they described the symptoms. They said, anybody else in your family like that? And I didn't say anything, but my wife turned her head, was looking directly at me. I'm like, yeah, probably. With hyperfocus, actually. So I can hyperfocus. Once I'm locked onto something, I can hyperfocus. But I will typically have sort of, you know, 17 things running through my head that I could or should be doing next. And I struggle to just, you know, put the 16 away and focus on the one. And obviously that's a challenge for a lot of people now, because like, as I speak to you now, I think I've got 24 tabs open on my computer, you know, which one will I hit after we finish this interview? So I fear I'm not very strategic about that. And I struggle to just stick with a task. And as soon as it becomes, they're a bit less rewarding intrinsically, I struggle to stick with it, and I'll go for something more immediately attractive. Oh, there's a shiny object over there. So the danger with somebody like me is I chase after the shiny object.
That can be a
blessing, of course, but it can also be a curse.
Yes, everything is a trade-off. So is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'd like to know what your biggest challenges are.
Community outreach, maybe. Getting the citizens and the town motivated and energized about the arts and our community.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think this issue of kind of engagement and participation is kind of hugely important. I mentioned that I become a US citizen, and on the anniversary of my becoming a citizen, every year I get out the letter that I got from the president. Obviously, it's a standard letter that everybody gets, and at the time it was President Obama. But I'm sure the letter's similar, regardless of who the president is. But in the letter, it says that you're called to the duties and joys of citizenship, and it says I strongly encourage you to engage in the life of your new nation, in its communities, and in its political life, in its cultural life, etc. And when you become a citizen, that's made explicit that actually that this participation, that being a citizen, and of course I'm still a UK subject of now His Majesty the King, as well as a citizen of the US. And the thing about citizenship is it's not just something you are; it's something that you do. And I think for a lot of people who are born into citizenship, that's not necessarily immediately apparent, that the republic doesn't build itself, that our communities don't repair themselves, that our relationships don't build themselves. And I'm always taken, there's a lovely line from one of my favorite philosophers, which was that good societies are built in the thick of daily life. And I love that, in the thick of daily life, not in a technocratic solution or a law or a bill, important those are, but in the thick of daily life. And one of my proposals, not in this book, but elsewhere, has been that I think it'd be great if all high schoolers went to a citizenship ceremony before they graduate from high school and just saw us take the oath and saw us becoming citizens and heard the message from the president and saw what it means to people to become a citizen. What a huge deal it is. I mean, it was a big deal for me, but wow, the Afghan family next to me, you know, the Iraqi family behind me, the Mexican family in front of me. I mean, just like tears, joy, flags, you know, you'd struggle to find a more patriotic ceremony than the citizenship ceremony. Absolutely. But you don't get exposed to that if you're born here. And so why not take all our high schoolers and have them witness the magic of becoming a citizen? And maybe that would help people appreciate it a little bit more. I fear that my fellow Americans sometimes take for granted some of the precious freedoms and opportunities and responsibilities that they have. And that actually, as a as someone who comes in, it's hard to take it for granted.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing your story, Richard.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for talking to me.
Mm-hmm. This is Community Connections. You have been listening to Richard Reeves, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of Boys and Men. And I'm Heather Rose with Radio Free Roanoke, 95.7 FM.
I'm Richard Reeves, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and you're listening to WROELP Roanoke.